Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. December 7th, 2010, in Vrindavan, Krishna Balaram Temple. Reading from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 9, text 2. And we're going to focus on the last two lines of the verse. And should I make that announcement at the beginning or the end of class? We'll make it the end, there'll be more people. Just remind me if I forget, okay? Should we chant the verse again today? Raja Vidya Raja Guyam Pavitram Idam Uttamam Pratyakshavagamam Dharmyam Susukam Kartamavyayam. Raja Vidya, the king of education. Raja Guyam, the king of confidential knowledge. Pavitram, the purest. Idam, this. Uttamam, transcendental. Pratyaksha, by direct experience. Avagamam, understood. Dharmyam, the principle of religion. Susukam, very happy. Kartum, to execute. Avyayam, everlasting. This knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. It is the purest knowledge, and because it gives direct perception of the self by realization, it is the perfection of religion. It is everlasting, and it is joyfully performed. So yesterday we talked about the first two lines, right? What did we talk about yesterday? Oh, no. King of education. Why is it the king? Of the soul, and not only the soul, but the soul's activities. And why is, and the next point is, it's the most confidential or secret. Why is it secret? Yes. Right. And the next point is it's the most pure. And what about that? What can you say about that? Yes. And also, what will it do? What will this knowledge do? Then the knowledge itself will purify you. Okay. And uttamam, it is above ignorance. And we talked yesterday about knowledge being like a treasure map. It was interesting, just today in my Chaitanya Charitamrita reading, I came to that story where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was telling Sanatana Goswami the story of the astrologer digging for treasure. I thought, oh, I just talked about that yesterday, so that was nice. So we're going to into the purport, and we're going to the middle of the purport. It will be the bottom of the second main page. So this is where Srila Prabhupada starts talking about the last two lines, because we're going to be focusing on that. Pratyaksha agamam dharmam susukam kartam avyayam. So pratyaksha, before we actually read the purport, we should all know what pratyaksha means. One of the main Sanskrit terms you learn in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness.
Getting the knowledge by own experience.
By your own experience. All right, we learn the word pratyaksha in connection with what? Yes, do you know what the other two ways are?
Anuman and Shabda.
Anuman and Shabda. And what do we usually say about those three ways? Pratyaksha, Anuman, and Shabda.
Shabda is our way.
That Shabda is our way. But here, Krishna is saying, you will understand this by pratyaksha, through experience. Okay, let's read Srila Prabhupada's purport. It is said that the execution of devotional service is so perfect that one can perceive the results directly. This direct result is actually perceived, and we have practical experience that any person who is chanting the holy names of Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. I was thinking once about the fact that Srila Prabhupada writes out the whole mantra so many times in his books, right? That this way nobody can come along later and say it should be a different mantra. In course of chanting without offenses, feel some transcendental pleasure and very quickly becomes purified of all material contamination. This is actually seen. Furthermore, if one engages not only in hearing, but in trying to broadcast the message of devotional activities as well, or if he engages himself in helping the missionary activities of Krishna consciousness, he gradually feels spiritual progress. This advancement in spiritual life does not depend on any kind of previous education or qualification. The method itself is so pure that simply by engaging in it, one becomes pure. So here Prabhupada is referring back to pavitram. But you may ask, well, how does it, you can get this experience just by the process. In the Vedanta Sutra 3.2.26, this is also described in the following words. Prakashascha karmani abhyasyat. Devotional service is so potent that simply by engaging in the activities of devotional service, one becomes enlightened without a doubt. A practical example of this can be seen in the previous life of Narada, who in that life happened to be the son of a maidservant. He had no education, nor was he born into a high family. But when his mother was engaged in serving great devotees, Narada also became engaged. And sometimes, in the absence of his mother, he would serve the great devotees himself. Narada personally says, Uchischa lepan anumodita dvijaha sakrit sama bunje tad apasta kilbisha evam pratistasya vishuddha chetasas tad dharma evatma ruchi prajayate. In this verse from Srimad Bhagavatam 1.5.25, Narada describes his previous life to his disciple Vyasadeva. He says that while engaged as a boy servant for those purified devotees during the 4 months of their stay, he was intimately associating with them. Sometimes those sages left remnants of food on their dishes, and the boy who had washed their dishes wanted to taste the remnants. So he asked the great devotees for their permission, and when they gave it, Narada ate those remnants and consequently became freed from all sinful reactions. As he went on eating, he gradually became as pure-hearted as the sages. The great devotees relished the taste of unceasing devotional service to the Lord by hearing and chanting, and Narada gradually developed the same taste. Narada says further, Tatran vahan krishna kata pragayatam anugrahena shrinavam mahohara tad shradhaya me nupadam vishrinvataha priyasravas anga mama bhavad ruchihi. We find ruchihi in both these verses. By associating with the sages, Narada got the taste for hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord, and he developed a great desire for devotional service. Therefore, as described in the Vedanta Sutra, the Prabhupada's quoting the same exact verse again, prakashascha karman yabhyasat. If one is engaged simply in the acts of devotional service, everything is revealed to him automatically, and he can understand. This is called prachaksha, directly perceived. The word dharmya means the path of religion. Narada was actually a son of a maidservant, so Prabhupada's continuing prachaksha agamam, now he's describing dharmyan, and he's continuing with the same example. He had no opportunity to go to school. He was simply assisting his mother, and fortunately his mother rendered some service to the devotees. The child Narada also got the opportunity, and simply by association achieved the highest goal of all religion. The highest goal of all religion is devotional service, as stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Savai Pum Samparo Dharmo Yato Bhaktir and Hokshaje. Religious people generally do not know that the highest perfection of religion is the attainment of devotional service. What do people generally engage in religion for? Dharma or Dakama Moksha. What specifically, the two main things people are looking for in religion? Artha and Kama, very much related, because by Artha you get Kama. Hard to get any Kama without any Artha. So they're looking for bhoga, they're looking for happiness and relief, salvation. So generally people take up religious life for two things, for enjoyment, and the top enjoyment is to go to heaven, to go to Swarga, or to go to Maui, if you can't make it all the way to Swarga. Maybe you can make it to Maui or Tahiti or something. Right? So people take up religion to enjoy the world or to get salvation from the world. That's generally the motives. But here Prabhupada's saying they don't know. They don't even know. So those of us in ISKCON, we may be worshiping Krishna. We probably are to some extent. Worshiping Krishna, trying to hope that it will get us pleasure or relief from distress. But at least we know that the goal is devotional service. Whereas most people in the world don't even know. They don't even have any idea of the goal. So Prabhupada said here, religious people generally do not know that the highest perfection of religion is the attainment of devotional service. As we have already discussed in regard to the last verse of chapter 8, Vedeshu Yagneshu Tapasu Chaiva, generally Vedic knowledge is required for self-realization. But here, although Narada never went to the school of the spiritual master and was not educated in the Vedic principles, he acquired the highest results of Vedic study. The process is so potent that even without performing the religious process regularly, one can be raised to the highest perfection. How is this possible? This is also confirmed in the Vedic literature. Acharyavan Purusho Veda, one who is in association with great acharyas, even if he is not educated or has never studied the Vedas, can become familiar with all the knowledge necessary for realization. Now Prabhupada goes on to the next words. So he's done Pratyaksha Bhagamam Dharmyam. Now he's going to go to Susukam Kartam. Kartam means actions. Susukam Kartam. So Sukha means happiness. And Su means very. Susukam, it's very happy. Kartam is activities. The activities are very happy. Many people think of religious activities as very austere. Here it says, very happy. The process of devotional service is a very happy one. Susukam. Why? Devotional service consists of Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu. So one can simply hear the chanting of the glories of the Lord, or can attend philosophical lectures on transcendental knowledge given by authorized acharyas. Simply by sitting, one can learn. Then I assume one has to be listening also, not just sitting. Not just sitting and sleeping. Then one can eat the remnants of the food offered to God, nice palatable dishes. In every state, devotional service is joyful. One can execute devotional service even in the most poverty-stricken condition. The Lord says, Patram Pushpam Palam Toyam. He is ready to accept from the devotee any kind of offering, never mind what, even a leaf, a flower, a bit of fruit, or a little water, which are all available in every part of the world, can be offered by any person, regardless of social position, and will be accepted if offered with love. How easy is that? Right? Of course, this verse is spoken at the end of the 9th chapter, where Krishna has been comparing, as he does in the 7th chapter, devotional service to worship of the demigods and to impersonalism, and he's making the point of how blissful it is. And just a little leaf, a little flower, a little fruit, a little water. Right? What person in the world can you make happy with that? Yeah. Those of you who are married, if you go to your husband or your wife and you say, just be happy with a piece of leaf, it probably wouldn't work. There are many instances in history. Simply by tasting the tulsi leaves offered to the lotus feet of the Lord, it's interesting, Prabhupada says he was tasting, usually says smelling. Great sages like Sanat Kumar became great devotees. Therefore, the devotional process is very nice, and it can be executed in a happy mood. What did Prabhupada just say? Executed in a happy mood. I can't count how many times I've met devotees who think that the measure of their surrender is how miserable they are in their service. I'm really serious. Everywhere I go in the world, I get people asking me that. Well, if I like my service, then isn't it Maya? Then isn't it just sense gratification? Shouldn't I intentionally choose a service that I don't like? Wouldn't that actually be surrender? And I say, you know, look, suppose you go to a company. If it's some business, they're manufacturing plumbing pipes. And all they want to do is make money. So does the boss of the company want his employees to be happy or miserable? Happy. Why? Yes. They'll work better. They'll be more productive. So even if you're an exploitive, materialistic demon, and you just want your employees to make more plumbing pipes for you, and you want them to be happy. Why just speak of Krishna? I really wonder what kind of a god people think we're worshiping. If his criteria for surrender is the more miserable you are, the more surrendered you are. A very peculiar idea of God. No wonder they don't want to surrender. Who wants to surrender to such a God who's worse than some boss in a plumbing pipe factory? So it can be executed in a happy mood. God accepts only the love which things are offered to him. That's interesting that Prabhupada has that one after another. Because if you're in love, you're going to be what? Happy. And you know, you're also more likely to feel loving if you're happy. So if you're in love, you're likely to feel happy, and if you're happy, you're more likely to feel loving. Did you know that? You know it's hard to feel loving if you're miserable? Did you know that? You ever tried to feel really loving when you're miserable? Okay. Now we're going on to Avyayam. It is said here that this devotional service is eternally existing. It is not, as the Mayavadi philosophers claim. Although they sometimes take to so-called devotional service, their idea is that as long as they are not liberated, they will continue their devotional service. But at the end, when they become liberated, they will, quote, become one with God, unquote. So that's so-called devotional service. Because if I have devotion for you, only the idea that I'm going to become you, that's not very much devotion, is it? Right? That's very selfish interest. When I was 17, I was a baker in a hotel, and the other people who worked in the kitchen, most of them, wanted to become the manager of the hotel. That was their aspiration. You know, they're there, whatever they're making, they're cooking this thing and that thing, washing the pots, and all the time they're thinking, when am I going to take over the position of the manager? So they, of course, they have to be very nice to the manager, because if they're nasty to the manager, then they'll be fired and they'll never get a chance to move up from pot washer to, you know, muffin baker, what to speak of, to get up to the head of the hotel. But their purpose is once they get there, they'll throw out the manager and take over his position. So that's not exactly devotional service. Such temporary, time-serving devotional service is not accepted as pure devotional service. When the devotee goes to the spiritual planet in the kingdom of God, he is also engaged there in serving the Supreme Lord. He does not try to become one with the Supreme Lord. So Prabhupada is saying, after liberation, one goes on serving. It's not that once one gets liberated, then one tries to become God. Then Prabhupada makes an interesting point. As will be seen in Bhagavad Gita, actual devotional service begins after liberation. After one is liberated, when one is situated in the Brahman position, Brahma Bhuta, one's devotional service begins. Sama sarveshu bhuteshu mad bhaktim labhate param. So what's happening before liberation? Practice. Does that mean that the practice is not real? Prabhupada uses the words here, actual. So is the practice devotional service not actual? Because we refer to the practice devotional service also as devotional service, don't we? Well, it's mixed, but we already know what the goal is. So although it's mixed, it's more like immature pure devotional service. So I've thought of it like a drama. Have any of you been in, who's here has been in a drama in your life? You guys didn't be in any dramas in school? They never made you be in a drama in school? So you have to do some practice first. Right? Prabhupada was in one drama when he was in a play about Lord Chaitanya, and he said that the instructor made them practice for 1 year. And then he said they all refused to practice anymore. They said, we're not going to practice anymore, we want to perform now. So is the practice part of the performance or not part of the performance? But also not part. When you are doing the practice, is that the real performance or not? No. But can you do the performance without the practice? If someone says, well, the practice is not the real performance, so let me immediately perform. My daughter for many, many years has taught Bharatanatyam dance, and she said she always had this problem, that the students just want to perform. They don't want to practice. So in terms of bhakti, we call this the prakriti sahajiyas. They want to immediately perform without practice. They want to say, oh, now I'm already at pure devotional service, but they don't want to go through the practice. Or sometimes we find that there are people who criticize and say, oh, you are not doing, it's not real bhakti. Real bhakti is only at a higher stage. So we could say, yes, it's a fact. Prabhupada says actual bhakti is at a higher stage. But without the practice, you can't come to the higher stage. So in one sense, it's all real bhakti. Another example given is an unripe fruit. So if there's an unripe mango, little green mango, or any little fruit, you can say it's a mango, but if you go to eat it, it won't be very nice. So is it a mango or is it not a mango? It's still a mango. Still a mango. You can't use it for very much. You can use it for pickle when it gets to be this big. Not when it's this big, dear. Not when it's really, really, really small. Can't use it for very much. But still, it's a mango. So in the practice stages of bhakti, it's not actual bhakti, yet it is actual bhakti in an immature state. But fully mature bhakti can only exist after liberation. And what Prabhupada's making the point here is that bhakti is eternal. Prabhupada's making this point in that context, that it's not that bhakti is a means to an end, that bhakti goes on eternally. And he's saying it doesn't stop after liberation. Not only does it not stop after liberation, really, it only starts after liberation. Another example could be that of a prison. We often compare the material world to a prison, right? So if you're in a prison and you go to the guards and you say, I want to reform. I'm tired of being a criminal. I want to reform. So do they let you out on the streets that day? No. So first you have to be in a reformatory program in the prison. And they're watching you. And as you start behaving, they'll start giving you more and more freedom. You may even start to be in charge of teaching other prisoners. Right? You may be given some responsibility. And then after a while, you come before the parole board. And maybe you were supposed to be in prison another 50 years. But they show all your good behavior. They say, okay, you've only been in prison 15 years, but we'll let you out. Now, are you fully free then? No. You have to have, I don't know what it's like in you're all from all over the world, because I used to teach civics in Gurukula. So sometimes we used to go to the courthouse. So you have a parole officer, and you have to check in with your parole officer regularly, and there's rules. Usually you can't leave a certain geographical area, certain things you can't do. They're still watching you. And you may be under parole for, you know, a year, 5 years, 10 years. At a certain point, then, you're free.
So very much like that in bhakti. When you first say, yes, I want to serve Krishna, so Maya Devi is still watching you. She's still watching you. Let me see how you behave. And pretty soon you start being given a little more freedom in the prison. Maybe even you have some responsibility to help other prisoners. The restrictions are a little loosened. And then you're let out on parole. So beginning liberation is just like that. You're free, but, you know, you're not fully in your original position. And Maya Devi's still keeping her eye on you. What are you doing? And if you mess up again, you can be dragged back. So when do you really start your activities as a free citizen is when you're out of the parole. Just at the time when you say to the warden, I want to be a good citizen, you don't immediately start acting like a free citizen. But yet, it's part of the process. So therefore, real bhakti begins when one is fully free. No one can understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead by executing Karma Yoga, Gyan Yoga, Ashtanga Yoga, or any other yoga independently. By these yogic methods, one may make a little progress towards bhakti yoga, but without coming to the stage of devotional service, one cannot understand what is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Oh, just those two sentences, we could probably speak for a few months. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is also confirmed that when one becomes purified by executing the process of devotional service, especially by hearing Srimad Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Gita from realized souls, then he can understand the science of Krishna or the science of God. Evam prasanna manaso bhagavad bhakti yogataha. When one's heart is cleared of all nonsense, then one can understand what God is. Thus, the process of devotional service of Krishna consciousness is the king of all... Now, Prabhupada's going all the way back to the beginning of the verse, is the king of education and the king of all confidential knowledge. It is the purest form of religion, and it can be executed joyfully without difficulty. Therefore, one should adopt it. Very wonderful purport. Prabhupada doesn't always do this in his purports, but in this particular purport, he goes through the verse word by word, explaining it, and then at the end of the purport, he practically restates the verse. This, of course, is one of the key verses of Bhagavad Gita. Raja vidya raja guyam pavitram idamutamam pratyakshavagamam dharmam susukam kartam avyayam. So, pratyaksha. We were talking yesterday about how this knowledge is a map. It's a map to the treasure of an eternal blissful life, which is what we're all desiring, to real success. Well, how do you know that you have a valid map? How do you know? With an ordinary map, how do you know it's the right map? If it's authorized by the government, then you'd be pretty sure because the government makes the roads. But how do you know for sure it's the right map? Okay, if you're following the map, you start to see the things that are on the map. That the names of the streets on the map correspond to the names of the streets that you're seeing, the different landmarks. Ultimately, how do you know it's the correct map? That helps. You start seeing it, yes? Yes, that's what he also said. It was given by the government. Right? Gets you where you want to go. It gets you where you want to go. Very simple. If I want to go to Delhi, and you give me a map, and instead of Delhi, I end up in Kolkata, and I followed your map, you know, if I followed the map, then there's something wrong with the map. So very, very simple. Therefore, in one sense, Madhvacharya says the ultimate evidence is always pratyaksha. It's interesting because generally we denigrate pratyaksha. Pratyaksha means sense perception. For example, how do I know that there is a brown wooden table here? Well, I see it and I feel it. But, you know, I see and feel things in my dreams too. How do I know that what I see and feel in my dreams doesn't exist and this table does exist? Well, but this also exists only for some period of time. Not very long ago it was a tree, and not very long from now it will be dirt. Yes, others can see it. Exactly. So if I had a dream last night about Parvati, and I said, oh, Parvati, you and I went to the Jamuna in my dream last night, she'd say, I didn't go to the Jamuna with you. So that way, you know, I had a dream last night. Actually, I had a dream I was at some big festival, and I was giving a class, and then they said, oh, no, you have to give a class on this book, and I wasn't prepared, and there were like 3,000 people there, and I didn't know what to say. That was what I was dreaming last night. But if I asked the other people in my dream, were you there, they would say, no. Therefore, we assume it's not real. And because everyone in this room will agree, I hope, that there's a brown wooden table here, therefore I assume that my perception is valid. Is it possible that all of us could be fooled? And that really there's no brown wooden table here at all? Is that possible? It certainly is possible. It certainly is possible. In fact, where is my sense perception taking place? You know, it's not really taking place in my hands or in my eyes. Do you know where it's taking place? In the mind. In the mind. There's just electrical impulses going in my brain, and my mind is interpreting that. It means this or it means that. I'm not actually interacting with this table directly at all. I'm interacting it with it very indirectly. And we all have experience of mass hallucination, shall we say, in the modern day with movies and video games. So if we were all at the present time watching some movie, especially the moon landing, yeah, that's a good example. So if we were all watching a movie, we'd all have a shared experience. We might show a movie here that somebody was climbing a mountain and they jumped from a helicopter to a mountain. And we'd all have that shared experience. But there's no helicopter and there's no mountain. There's just a screen and there's lights. But our brain is being fooled into thinking that that's the experience. And often people will become emotionally involved in a movie, don't they? Right? As if it's really happening. Or what to speak of a computer game, if you've ever seen any of these modern games where people assume a character in the game and they interact with other characters and they have, again, a shared experience. But it's not actually happening. Of course, something is happening. There's electricity, there's ones and zeros in the computer. But what they think is happening is not happening. So this whole world is compared like that to a shared dream. And if there were movies and computer games, I'm sure at the time the Shastra was written, they would have used those as examples. So this world is very much like a shared dream. Therefore, we cannot trust our pratyaksha. We cannot trust it. When people are playing a computer game, and I've seen people playing games, I haven't played them myself, but I've seen people playing them, and they become very absorbed in them to the point that they're practically experiencing them, and they forget who they are. So we also become absorbed. And we see on a practical level, our senses are so often just wrong. I'll think there's a person standing there, and it's really a light pole, right? And so many times, my senses fool me. And even shared experiences can be wrong. So we don't put much stress on this pratyaksha. And then anuman is logic. Material logic, yes. Anuman is, okay, well, I have this Prabhupada gives the example that all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. But how do I know that all people are mortal? I'd have to examine every person. And I can't examine every person. And I don't even know what percentage of people I've examined, so I'm not even sure what percentage of the truth I'm getting. So therefore we say the only truth is shabda, that which comes from authority. But ultimately, how do I know that it's come from authority? The only way is through experience. How do I know? It's a valid map. My ultimate test is whether or not it gets me to my destination. Therefore, the ultimate proof is really pratyaksha. And therefore, Prabhupada is saying in this purport, and he says in many, many places, that what is our ultimate test of whether or not Krishna consciousness is working? our own experience. He says, like, you don't need a certificate from someone else to tell you if you've eaten enough. Can you imagine? You're at the feast and you turn to the person next to you and you say, have I eaten enough? Am I satisfied? I mean, maybe if you have some kind of eating disorder. But generally, we know our hunger is gone. We feel nourished. We feel satisfied. In the same way, Prabhupada said, we should be able to tell ourselves. We should be able to see. We had such a nice talk last night. It was so wonderful when we were talking about how devotional service purifies and the value of distributing books to people. And we were talking about how when we first came to Krishna consciousness, we didn't understand it and we gradually understood it. I was thinking about that a lot last night. And how I really tried to remember how little I understood about spiritual life when I first started this process. I didn't understand practically anything. And I thought, wow, I really do understand a lot more than I did then. And none of it's from me. It's just from this process. It's just from Srila Prabhupada. I was feeling so grateful and awed by the potency of the process. So sometimes we may say, well, I don't know if it works because I'm not yet experiencing unlimited ecstasy. You read about the pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu with his devotees and what kind of ecstatic moods the devotees would get into, how they would forget their bodies, they'd forget everything. That's what happens when you're in love. If any of you have ever been even materially in love, that's what happens. You forget everything, at least for a while, until you realize that the object of your love isn't quite what you thought he or she was. And then it's not quite the same. It doesn't last, unfortunately. But there's some little imitation of that in this world, that you forget everything when you're in love. So we may say, well, I'm not experiencing that yet. But if we compare what kind of realization we have, what kind of knowledge we have, what are our tastes? Do we still have the same taste for materialistic life? And we'll see that the process is working. Right? Just like you're saying with the map, it's not just your destination, but the signs along the way, isn't it? If ever you give someone directions, don't you tell them what to look for on the way? There was some devotees here from Mumbai, from Chaupati, and they came to visit me at the Sandipani Muni school. So I wrote a little map. I said, okay, you go on the Parikram path, you take the first right, and I wrote down bad road. I said, and then you make a little turn and you kind of go straight, and the first thing you'll find is a mud puddle. Those are my landmarks that I gave them. A big mud puddle. You know, or the bicycle repair man you'll come to the bicycle repair man on the side of the road and take a right onto the bumpy road, go through the mud puddle. Right, we give them some landmarks, right? Don't you always do that? Some landmarks. Come to this building, or you come to this person, or you come to this thing. Why do we give landmarks? Yes. You don't want to wait till you get to your destination to find out you went the wrong way. That would be very inconvenient. You want to have some signposts along the way. You call them landmarks, something that marks the land. So therefore, the process of devotional service is given in stages. And so far, I've identified 16 different descriptions of the process of devotional service. What are the different landmarks? So that you can tell, am I making progress? You know, did I come to the muddy ditch? Did I come to the bicycle repair man? You know, what did I come to? Am I on the right path? So we should see that we're making progress. It should be something we can perceive ourselves. It's not just a question of going to other people and saying, am I making any advancement? And what are the main things we should be coming to? Susukham. We should be joyful. Not the kind of happiness that comes and goes in this world. That's a very common mistake. That when I'm feeling the material happiness, I think now I'm making advancement. And when I feel materially sad, I think now I'm not making advancement. My dear friends, Matris Parshas to Kantaya Sitos Na Sukadukada Agama Payano Nityas Tam Tatikshvasubharata. Sukaduka, there's going to be material happiness and distress. It will come and go. Even Prabhupada says in the purport to 1422, as long as you have a material body, you're going to find happiness and distress, and there's going to be the influence of the modes of material nature. That means if you have a material body, sometimes your body will feel tired. Sometimes your body will feel energetic. And sometimes your mind will feel tired, too. Prabhupada said in every activity, there's periods of activity and periods of rest. Sometimes your mind will feel tired and sad, and sometimes your mind will feel energetic and happy, just like sometimes your body will feel that way. Right? Everybody, sometimes your body feels energetic, and sometimes your body doesn't feel energetic, and sometimes your mind is enlivened, and sometimes your mind is kind of sloggy. And Prabhupada said that will continue as long as one has a material body. So that's not the kind of joy we're talking about. We're talking about a kind of joy that exists during the ups and downs of the body and the mind. That's not dependent on the ups and downs of the body and the mind. That's not dependent on the mind. So to what extent am I feeling that joy? And we've all experienced that joy at least a little. Maybe in some kirtans, or with some prasadam, or with some wonderful thing we read in the books, or with our japa, or with some seva. I felt that cleaning the toilets, washing the pots, where we feel some joy that has a different quality. I mean, that was what convinced me ultimately to join the Hare Krishna movement. I was certainly very much enlivened by what I understood of the philosophy, especially about karma and reincarnation. I thought, oh, that makes a lot of sense. But what really convinced me was that I experienced a quality of joy that was radically different from anything material. Because it's real. It's touching the self, dharmyam, therefore, real religion. Real religion is savai pum sam paro dharmo yato bhaktir hokchaje ahoitu ki apritiyata yad yatma supersedti. It gives actual satisfaction to the self. I'm talking about sense perception. What's the difference between the food you eat in a dream? Have you all eaten food in a dream? Everybody here eating food in a dream? No, you've never eaten food on a dream? Try sleeping when you're fasting. I've had incredible feasts if I've fallen asleep on a fast day. Pakoras and all kinds of things. And you can taste the food in the dream. But somehow that's not satisfying. I remember once having a dream where I was drinking water, gallons and gallons and gallons of water. And at one point in the dream I thought, why is am I still thirsty? And immediately I woke up and I thought I was dreaming. So dream water or dream food doesn't satisfy you. Right? You have to eat real food. So material, there's a difference between dream food and real food, although in the dream you can taste the food. So there's a difference between material happiness and spiritual happiness. It has a different quality. And even a neophyte can recognize that. You know, when you taste that prasadam, it doesn't happen all the time, but when you taste that prasadam, you go, wow. Isn't it? Something you can't explain just by the ingredients in the food, as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gives that example. He said, we all know these ingredients. What is that flavor? Or something in the kirtan, the musicians may not be, you know, the best musicians in the world. They may not be able to play at Carnegie Hall, but you experience some happiness that you never felt listening to Mozart or the Rolling Stones or whatever you like. Isn't it? Right? That kind of joy, and when that kind of joy starts being more and more and more a part of your life, susukha. That's the pratyaksha. One gets actual realization. It's not just some ideas in a book. You start living it and seeing it. Oh, there really are modes of material nature. Wow, God really is a person. He really is kind. He really is wonderful. There really is something beyond the mind. when the philosophy starts becoming realized and when one starts becoming joyful. Now, what is the secret? We were talking a little bit about this yesterday. Yesterday we were talking about the concept of taking pleasure in the activity of devotional service, finding success in the activity of devotional service rather than in some sort of external result, right? We were talking about that yesterday. So it's interesting that I was listening to that this morning, reading that this morning in Chaitanya Charitamrita, where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was explaining to Sanatana Goswami about fruitive activities. We use this word a lot, fruitive activities. So generally in this world, where do we look for happiness? In some sort of result. I do something. I think I am the doer, kartaham iti manyate. I am the doer of this activity, and I am doing this activity in order to get some pleasure out of the result of this activity. Right? I plant a seed. We were reading that also. I plant a seed. I grow a tree. Why? So I can harvest the figs or the mangoes or the whatever it is and eat them or sell them. And if I don't get any fruit, then it's useless. It was a waste of time. Now think about for a minute the happiness that comes from fruitive activity. First of all, how often does one get the fruits of one's activity? Constantly or just periodically? Periodically. Do the fruits we get, are they always what we expected? Are they sometimes the opposite of what we expected? Can we control them? No. Okay, so just think, fruitive activity means your happiness is dependent on something that happens only periodically, that you have no control over, or very, very little control over, and that may be the opposite of what you desire. Does that sound like a very happy life? If that's the source of your happiness. So that means the majority of the time you're not going to have any happiness. Your only happiness will be in anticipation. When am I going to get the fruit? When am I going to get, when am I going to, when? Your happiness is very what oriented? Future oriented. Your happiness is very, very future oriented. Are you happy in the present? No, you're just thinking, when will I be happy in the future? And you're imagining this whole future where you're going to be happy. When this happens and this happens and this happens. And you're trying to control that future. But because you're not the controller, what are you going to feel? If you're trying to get your happiness over something over which you had limited control, what are you going to feel? A lot of anxiety. And if other people, especially other people, seem to block your ability to control, what are you going to feel? Very angry. Okay, so most of the time you're going to feel anxiety and anger. Fear and anger and attachment. Attachment, fear, and anger. And then you finally get to that fruit. It may not even be there. There may be no fruit. Or it may be bitter. And sometimes it's sweet. And how long then do you enjoy the fruit? And then again, what are you doing? Another one. That's material happiness. That's the sum and substance of material happiness. So spiritual happiness, the susukam Krishna's talking about, it's a very, very different thing. Because in the spiritual world, there's no past and future. Oh, and people who are fruitive actors, not some of them are really focused on the future and some are really focused on the past. Oh, I planted that tree and I got a bitter fruit and I planted this tree and I didn't get any fruit and this person got in my way and if only I could have gotten rid of this person. The hankering and lamenting, socchitina kanchati. Or a little of both. Lamenting over the past and hankering over the future. So the susukam is very different. Devotional service means, and Prabhupada keeps quoting here Narada Muni with rati, or ruchi rather, that one is getting, what the taste one is getting is constant, avyayam, eternal. Eternal means it's always going on. Susukam kartam avyayam. It's a constant flow of joy. This is the pratyaksha. This is what we should be experiencing. And my dear friends, please do not think that this is the realm of only the advanced devotees. This is something that anybody, even a beginner, can start to experience whenever we want. Very, very, very simple. Whatever I'm doing at this moment, I offer this moment to Krishna. That's all. And when I'm relishing my ruchi, my taste, is what I'm offering right now, this moment. Now, let's say you're working on some project, your simple project, like you're knitting something there. What are you knitting? What are you knitting? Yes. What is that? You're making a picture. Oh, a cover for, like a chutter for the picture. Okay. So, let's say that your happiness was in the fruit. So then you'll feel happy when you make the little chutter for the picture and it turns out the way you wanted and you put it on the picture. Okay. But instead of doing it that way, why not, as you're knitting it, you're offering it to Krishna as if it's already done. With every time, because you know you may not finish it. So many things could happen. Somebody could take your yarn, you could leave your body and be in Goloka Vrindavan. Right? So many things could happen between now and you're actually finishing your chatter. It might not get finished. Or it might get finished and some monkey will steal it. Right? So many things. Correct? No. So if your happiness is in putting it on the picture, that may not happen. But if as you're knitting it, you're meditating on, I'm putting it on the picture, 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 then it's already there. And then, even if you don't get to finish it, even if instead of finishing it, somebody calls you to go to Chennai and you have to go there and it never gets finished, it doesn't matter. Because it was already offered. Therefore, Prabhupada says, devotional service doesn't have to be completed externally like material things do. And Prabhupada talks very often about making this offering mentally and how it's the same as what's offered physically. With every flower you put on, you're offering the garland. That it doesn't need to be completed. If it's completed, very nice. But that's not under our control. What's under my control is whether or not I'm offering what I'm doing right now. And in the spiritual world, there's only right now. Do you know the thing that's least like the spiritual is future? Because you know what? There's never a future. Is there ever a future? No. You could say there was a past. It's the least real thing. The whole idea of past, present, and future is the beginning of the material illusion. You all know that? What's the very first thing, Mahavishnu? What's the first thing Mahavishnu does when he's going to manifest the illusion of material life? Time. And time is his glance, which is also what personality? Lord Shiva. Prabhupada says when Krishna says time I am, he's referring to Lord Shiva. So it's time that starts the whole material illusion. That the beginning of illusion is this concept of past, present, and future. In the spiritual world, it's always the present. So one way we can be in reality now is to be very much absorbed, as Bhaktivinoda Thakura says, forget the past that sleeps and ne'er the future dream at all, but bear with times that are with thee in progress thee shall call. Is to be fully absorbed. What am I giving to Krishna now? 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 How am I reciprocating with Krishna now? How am I pleasing my spiritual master now? Not after I set all this up and this up and this up and do this and do this and do that and go here and do this, then I'll start pleasing Guru and Krishna. That was what Prahlad Maharaj's friend said to him. First we have to do this, then we have to do this, then. That's the materialistic way of thinking. First I have to do this, then I have to do this, then I have to do this. Then I'll be happy. But first I have to do this, then I have to do this. Then I'll be Krishna conscious. When I get to Vrindavan, then I'll be Krishna conscious. Why can't you be Krishna conscious standing in the security line? Why can't you be Krishna conscious packing your bag? Who knows? That may be your last minute. You may never get on the plane. Right? You don't know. So that's susukam. And the more one is experiencing that, the direct experience, pratyaksha. And what are some symptoms? We know even at Sattvagun, the gates of the body are illumined by knowledge. One feels full of light, and one feels very free. If my happiness is no longer dependent on results, if my happiness is now completely under my control, that's freedom, isn't it? Isn't that nice? That's ahoituki apratiyata. It's not stopped by any obstacles. You know, the non-devotees have love songs like that. There ain't no mountain high enough and no river wide enough to keep me from getting to you. Right? They have this concept of ahoituki apratiyata. It's very much like the avyayam here. It keeps going. So real happiness, yadyatma supersedati, real happiness can only be when we go to that point where it doesn't matter, whatever the obstacles are. Because my happiness isn't dependent on something external to me. It isn't dependent on some result. It isn't dependent on some conditions. It's just dependent on my relationship with Krishna now. And Prabhupada's quoting Patram Pushpam Palam Toyam. You don't even have to have a Patram Pushpam Palam Toyam. You can offer it in your mind if that's all you have. Isn't that amazing? If you're in a condition where you don't even have a leaf to offer, you can be cooking sweet rice in your mind and going to the Ganga and the Jamuna, and Krishna will accept that. You can build a path for the Lord out of jewels in your mind and build, and Krishna will accept that. That's not an excuse for just sitting around and doing things in your mind. But no matter what we're doing with our body, we're offering it to Krishna. So that is our direct evidence. Anyone can do that, and anyone can experience that. And when you have that kind of happiness, material happiness is really not very interesting. If one cannot have, as Prabhupada says later in the Bhagavad Gita, a thrill at every moment that's independent of who's treating me nicely and who's not treating me nicely and what the weather is and how muddy the roads are and whether or not the monkey stole my banana or whatever it is, you know, it's just not dependent on anything like that. It's only dependent on whether or not I choose to relate with Krishna right now, which I can do all the time because, well, he's in my heart. He's right there. Why would I go back to some happiness that I get only periodically, that's not under my control, that's not real even, and that a lot of times doesn't even happen? So therefore, one should test oneself. One should test oneself. Prabhupada said, if you're eating a meal and you're not satisfied, then either you're not really eating, I guess you're just sort of chewing gum, or there's parasites in your belly taking the nourishment. So if we're not starting to feel this susukam kartam in our activities, then either we're not really in Krishna consciousness. We may look like we're in Krishna consciousness, like the person chewing gum looks like they're eating. But there's no real eating going on. Or there's some parasites, there's some serious offenses, especially Vaishnava aparadha. If we're going around being envious of devotees and criticizing devotees and hating devotees and trying to hurt devotees, and then it's impossible to dedicate every moment to Krishna. You're too busy worrying about how to hurt all the other devotees to think about Krishna. So this is our nice test, such a beautiful verse. So practical. Pratyakshavakamam dharmyam susukam kartam aviyam. It's joyfully performed. It's constant flow of joy that can be directly experienced. And at least we should be experiencing that joy is coming sometimes and more and more and more and more often. And if it isn't, then we need to redirect our consciousness. If it isn't, then we're following the wrong map. And we need to go back to the proper map, to be Krishna conscious, manmana bhava madbhakto, to always be constantly dedicating our heart and our mind to Krishna. So we can stop here. I want to make an announcement. See, I remembered. Matasmatir Ganam Apohanamcha. So on December 17th, it's Ekadasi, and there will be a program here. Is that for ladies only? For ladies only. Sorry, guys. That from 8:30 until Mangal Arti, you can come here and read and chant, and 8:30 at night until Mangal Arti in the morning. So those of you who want to do a whole Ekadasi Vrat and stay up all night, make sure you bring warm clothes. And if you want to come with the other ladies here in Prabhupada's library, that facility will be available. So is that correct? Did I make the announcement correctly? 8:30 or 8:30? 8:30 at night until Mangal Arti. So those really determined Ekadasi Vrata persons. During the day, there will be chanting of the whole Bhagavad Gita in Sanskrit. Okay, so that'll be in the temple room, and then... Okay, any ladies who can chant a whole chapter of Bhagavad Gita, please come see Parvati. Okay, for Gita Jayanti. All right, any other announcements to everybody out in Radio Land? Any questions, comments, additions, subtractions? Oh, I should also make an announcement that tomorrow at Govardhan is a 12-hour kirtan from 9 in the morning till 9 at night. And there are rides available at 7:30 in the morning and at 9:30 in the morning outside the MVT gate. It's 300 rupees. That'll take you there and back and give you lunch. And if you're interested in going, you need to call as soon as possible Adi Purusha or someone else whose name is up on the VIHE board, because there's rides leaving at 7:30 and at 9:30 if you want to be in the 12-hour kirtan. Returning, something like 6 or 7 in the evening, because the kirtan goes on to 9. I'm not sure if they're staying till 9. Yes. Oh, yeah, take the mic so that everybody on the radio can hear you.
About sinful activities, and you said you were just going to touch on the pious activities that we can do...
And I never did get back to that, did I?
No.
Wow. That's good. Sheesh. So would you like me to do that now, since I said I was going to and I didn't? I'm so sorry. You caught me. So generally in the material world, we talk about a demarcation between sinful activities and pious activities. We talk about karma and vikarma, which is Prabhupada explains in the Ishopanishad. And sinful activities are those, as also, of course, explained in the 16th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So sinful activities are those which are against the Shastra, and pious activities are those which are according to the Shastra. But on another level, anything that's not bhakti is sinful. And that very much relates to the two lines I said that we could talk about for months, which is at the very end of this purport. Prabhupada talks about how all the different kinds of yoga will not bring you perfection. Let's see, what did he say? Without coming to the stage of devotional service, one cannot understand what is the personality of Godhead. So why is it only that anything other than devotional service is more or less sinful? But what we're doing is we're calling the higher grades of sin piety. They're also piety in the sense that if you're following the scriptures, it's easier to perform bhakti. And following the scriptures may lead you to bhakti, because if you're following the scriptures will also point you to bhakti. You'll associate with brahmanas, and they may tell you about bhakti. You'll perform yajñas, and in the yajñas you'll chant the name of Vishnu, or you'll chant Om. So that those sort of activities may lead you to bhakti. But really, sin is anything that's against our nature. If you think of it like this, that here's a metal cup full of water. So if I drink the water, that's healthy for me, and if I try to eat the cup, I'll break my teeth or I'll become ill. So really, the only things that are pious are things which are in accord with my nature, and anything that's sinful is something that's not in accord with my nature. It's not exactly that Krishna's there like, oh, you don't want to worship me, you know, let me punish you. It's not really exactly like that. But I'm choosing to eat a metal cup, and therefore I get a stomachache. So my nature, my dharma, and we could have talked about this today too, but, you know, so we could talk about for months and months on this one verse. The essential dharma of the soul is service, and service to Krishna. Not just service, but service. That's my nature. It's like there's a certain kind of food that's meant for my body. You know, metal is not the food that's for my body. It doesn't fit. Or even one of our arguments against meat eating is that meat eating doesn't fit the physiology of the human body. We don't have the proper saliva or teeth or intestines. And therefore, if you eat meat, the body is not healthy. So any activities which are not in accord with my nature bring some sort of sinful reaction. And anything that's not bhakti is not in accord with my nature. Therefore, it brings some reaction. And that's why there's suffering. So as soon as I'm not functioning in accord with my nature, I'm in conflict, therefore, with everything. Like the metta would come into conflict with my body. So I'm in conflict with nature, therefore I have the adidaivic miseries. I'm in conflict with other living entities, so I have the adibodhic miseries. And I'm in conflict with my own body and my own mind, so therefore I have the adiatmic miseries. I'm doing something that's opposed to the truth. I'm doing something that's false. I'm doing something that's a lie. So anything that's predicated on having myself as the center, even if it's according to the karmakanda rituals of the Vedas, is in a sense sinful. Therefore, Prabhupada would say everyone in the material world is a thief. Whether you steal a diamond or a cucumber, you're still a thief. Does that make sense? So even the great demigods, if their motive is selfish, it's still materialistic. It may be a higher grade. And yet we can distinguish and say that the higher grades of sin are more favorable for bhakti than the lower grades of sin. If you're eating bhoga vegetarian food, that's better than if you're eating cows or people. So we draw a line and we say, okay, above this line is piety and below this line is sin. And then there are degrees of sin. Right? I mean, it's worse to eat a goat than to eat a fish. It's worse to eat a cow than to eat a goat. And it's worse to eat a person. And it's worse to eat a brahmana or your mother or your child. Or, you know, so the degrees. And then there's degrees of piety. But in another sense, anything that's not our original nature is not going to make us happy, even if it's at the highest levels of piety. Is that okay? Oh, sporting activities. My goodness. When I was writing the book Vaikuntha Children years and years, how many years ago did I write that? 15 years ago? So I wanted to write about engaging the children in sports. So I wrote to 10 or 15 of the leaders in ISKCON and I said, please define frivolous sports. I got zero replies. I haven't been able to find practically, I found a few people who are willing to try it. But most people aren't even willing to try it. So I could tell you my own understanding, but I would just be telling you my own understanding. So my own understanding is something that's just spectator. I'm watching you play sports. That seems pretty frivolous to me. Something that has no purpose, no function, doesn't give you any exercise value, that seems pretty frivolous to me. So if something has exercise value. Also, there seems to be a difference with children and adults. I mean, Prabhupada taught the children all kinds of games and encouraged us that we should have the children play games and sports in the Gurukul. I mean, I was over at the Gurukul yesterday and the kids are just while we were waiting for the teacher to come in, these little boys are just racing around the room. And I was thinking, you know, adults never do that. Could you imagine if before this class started, you know, if you guys came in and just started running around the room back and forth? That's what they were doing. They weren't even playing a particular game, you know, just you know. So you have to do something with that energy. But Prabhupada, of course, would do exercise. He would take a walk an hour and a half a day. That's a lot of time to spend on exercise. An hour and a half a day he would spend. So I'd say it depends. I'm sorry, I can't, you know. If you can ever find some authority, and now we don't have a GBC statement on this. I don't think it will ever happen. What is a frivolous sport? So again, you also have to have some honesty. Is this helping me in my Krishna consciousness or not? Is it necessary or not? Am I coming closer to Krishna or not? I mean, you have to have a little thoughtfulness. Another thing that I would, and I hope I'm not going to get in trouble for this, but co-ed sports in my book would be in the level of frivolous. And this was a long time ago, 20, 25 years ago. We were at one temple, and the temple president and vice president stopped my husband and I as we were walking into the temple, and they said, "We don't think you're really members of this community." Why? What happened? "Well, you didn't come to the volleyball game." I swear. And I said, "Well, nobody even invited us." And the vice president looks at the president, he said, "Well, no, I didn't invite them because I knew they wouldn't come." And the president said, "Well, why not?" He said, "Well, it was co-ed. I knew they wouldn't participate." Krishna. So that's, you know, if you want to have Urmila Uvacha, then I'd say spectator sports, co-ed sports, you know. And then if you're going to talk about excessive, but you know, what's excessive for one person may not be excessive for another. It depends. And that depends what your service is. So Peter Burwash, you all know who Peter Burwash is? Any of you know who Peter Burwash is? So Peter Burwash was, I think, number 90 in the world as a tennis player, which is pretty good. He was really up there as a tennis player. That was his profession. That was his job, was to be a tennis player. And Prabhupada told him, play tennis for Krishna. He met Prabhupada many, many times. He never got initiated. He asked Prabhupada to initiate him at 8 rounds. Prabhupada said, no, 16. He's a very good man. He's never broken the regulative principles his whole life. Very, very good man. He still does a lot of service for ISKCON, a lot of service for the devotees. Prabhupada also told him to preach about vegetarianism, and he does that. He goes into businesses and preaches about vegetarianism. But he runs a tennis training company. That's one of the ways he makes his income. And he's given a lot of large donations to ISKCON. How does he do that? By training people to play tennis. So that's what he is. So for him, playing tennis wasn't a frivolous sport. It was his occupation. And there was no question of him for it being excessive. You know, if he was playing tennis 8 hours a day, that wasn't excessive because that was his job. So, it's also individual circumstances.
During festivals, Prabhupada also spent a long time just speaking with him,
yes,
and making him sit there and listen to, having him learn how he deals with people.
Yeah, he's wonderful.
He learned what he learned from Srila Prabhupada.
Yeah, Prabhupada put a lot of energy into training him. And Prabhupada never said, "Oh, your whole job is sinful, it's a frivolous sport." So, I mean, I there's one devotee, I think, who's a chess champion also. So my answer is it depends. And you have to use, as Prabhupada told Burajan, use some common sense, and if you don't have any, ask somebody who does. I always hope nobody ever asks me that question. What's a frivolous sport? Yes? Please don't have any more questions on sports.
You told us that some people thinking that if they're enjoying by the service, devotional service, it's some kind of sense gratification. I'm thinking that one time Srila Prabhupada, in one of his letters, I remember I read it, he said that we should not be attached to our service. So if temple president or somebody, some management wants to change our service, should accept it as the normal, as not fight for that.
Okay, well, this also has to be understood in context. So when you're in the training, in ideal society, you're going to be a brahmachari when you're a little child. Okay, you're a young child. Gurukul is up until about age 12. And part of the training for the young child was obedience. That you're told you do this and you obey. But part of the responsibility of those training the child is to engage the child according to that person's nature. So yes, of course, you know, there's emergency duties. Prabhupada says there's ordinary desired in emergency. So if there's an emergency, you should be willing to do anything. Not that you say, well, I can't do anything if there's an emergency. But the authorities also have a responsibility to engage people according to their nature. And if authorities are constantly engaging people according to emergencies and needs without taking into account the nature of the persons, then they're not doing their proper service as authorities. And they're damaging people. So, and then one has some responsibility to go and say, wait a minute, you know, this is not my nature. And I'm dying here. I can't function. So it's quite interesting in the Gita, Krishna never tells Arjuna, do someone else's duty. Does he? Did anybody find that verse? Arjuna, don't act according to your own nature. Instead, if you want to surrender, please do someone else's duty. Did anyone know where that verse is in the Bhagavad Gita? I've been looking for that verse for a long time. I haven't been able to find it. What does Krishna say in the Bhagavad Gita? It's interesting that he says it twice. Now, this is one of my, things, because I'm so tired of finding devotees being miserable in the name of Krishna consciousness. Something that really bothers me. So sorry if I'm a little emotional about it, but it really bothers me. I feel pain. The way I'm going to be Krishna conscious is to be miserable. What about susukam kartamavyam? I don't know. You know, and a good teacher repeats something that's important. And a good teacher repeats the most important thing in the summary. So the 18th chapter, Krishna summarizes, and the very end of the 18th chapter, again he repeats what's in the third chapter. He says, you're going to do your nature anyway. You can't stop doing your nature. You know what your nature is? What we mean by your nature? We mean something that makes you happy. Did you know that? Something that fits. It's just like each of us, if we went to an Ayurvedic doctor, they could tell us what food would be perfectly suitable for us. We each have a certain nature, kapha, vitta, pitta, vata, right? You all know about this? So there's certain foods for each of us that suit us and certain foods that don't. It's not that all of us can digest exactly the same kind of foods. So also there's certain kinds of work that suit us and certain kinds of work that don't. There's some kind of food that resonates with our body and some kind of food that doesn't. And there's some kind of work that resonates with our psychological nature and some kind of work that doesn't resonate with our psychological nature. And what Krishna tells Arjuna is, whatever your nature is, you're going to do it anyway. Why? Because that's the kind of machine you have. He says, you can't do someone else's nature. It won't even work. Don't even try. You're going to do your own nature anyway. What will repression accomplish? That doesn't mean you shouldn't repress your urges to kill people. It means you can't repress your nature. And what does Krishna say your choices are? He said, you have two choices. Do your nature for Maya or do your nature for me. That's it. Bus. Let's finish. So, there's two levels of being happy in Krishna consciousness. One is on the material level, that if I'm engaging according to my nature in Krishna service, then even on a material nature, I'll feel happy because I'm getting the proper nourishment from my psychophysical nature. And then there's another kind of happiness, which is that I'm offering that nature to Krishna, not just externally engaging in Krishna consciousness, but internally. And that's the susukam kartamavyayam. Because materially, I might feel enlivened if I'm in the right job. But that could happen even materially. But you want both there. But emergency, of course. Emergency should be an emergency. Emergency means it doesn't happen very often and it doesn't happen for very long. So if there's the 365-day emergency, that's bad management. And it kills people. It kills people. And it's very damaging. So of course, if you're a good servant, you're willing to do emergency work. Naturally. Naturally, but that shouldn't be confused. And if you're doing emergency work, if I'm offering to Krishna, then there's transcendental happiness. But how long can you ride a bicycle as if it's a motorcycle? Not for very long. If you've got a bicycle, you got a bicycle. If you try to force it to be like a motorcycle, you know, you'll fall over exhausted and dead. So both have to be there. Is that okay?
About children, Rukula, they're always engaged in studying. I have experience with my nephew. He didn't want to study at all. He was 2 years in Mayapur International School. And
what child wants to study?
He doesn't want to do anything, so I sent him back to Uzbekistan, so he now suffers. He has no association of devotees, nothing, but he didn't want
to. I can't speak about individual cases, but children are supposed to study whether they like it or not. That's not, that has to be there. You don't say to the child, I mean, some people do this, but I could never relate to that. Now, would you like to do your mathematics today? You know, that's not, I don't know the individual case. So I think we should end. Is there something else? Yes, Parvati.
Just one small comment that I have seen different devotees who have been forced into emergency kind of services for long periods of time and eventually have become very extraordinarily ill. Because they would force themselves to do it, even though it wasn't their nature. So I've seen devotees that actually become very ill as a result of it. And the other comment is that...
And doesn't Krishna say that? He said, better to do your own duty, even if imperfectly, than to do someone else's duty, even perfectly, to follow another's path is dangerous. So, and I'd say it's dangerous both materially and spiritually. And I'd also say, you know, folks, it really doesn't matter. If you have a bicycle this life, it's okay, you know. If you have a boat, it's okay. It doesn't matter. It's very temporary. It's 8 billionths of a second for Lord Brahma. It just doesn't matter. Whatever you have, just be honest about what you have and use that in Krishna's service. And don't worry about it. You know, and the way to be Krishna conscious, take what you have, know what you have, and use it in Krishna's service. Doesn't matter.
And then what Prabhupada liked was that once you do know what you're supposed to be doing, you should just stick with it and develop it and stay with it and be consistent and don't
and
change.
Become expert.
Yeah, become expert and don't be fickle and change.
Become
just
expert.
Do it.
Yeah. Of course, there's a certain part of our nature that does change. So the varna part of our nature is consistent and the ashram part of our nature changes. So the majority of people are going to go through 3 and possibly 4 ashram changes in life. And that's also part of nature. So there's a certain point at which, you know, for most people, your nature changes. At first you're, you know, okay, I'm a renunciate. I'm just doing whatever I'm told. And to, okay, I want to have my own house and my own money and my own kitchen and my own thing. And then at a certain point that changes and says, you know, okay, enough of this, having my own house and my own kitchen and my own money, you know. I don't want it anymore. Now I just want to have one box full of clothes and live on the road and whatever. And that does change. And most people go through a psychological change in terms of ashram in the course of their life. Most people go through, let's say, at least 2. Prabhupada said for the Shudras there's only Grahastha, for the Vaishyas there's Grahastha and there's Brahmachari and Grahastha. For the Kshatriyas there's Brahmachari, Grahastha and Vanaprastha, and for the Brahmanas there's all 4 ashrams. But even the higher class women go through 3 ashrams. So that changes. But one's varna is going to be the same. And even when one transcends one's psychophysical nature, you know, even when you realize that I'm not really this bicycle or I'm not really this motorboat, you know, still in this world generally we continue to serve that way, to set an example. So thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. All glories to the Bhagavad Gita. Jai. All glories to Parvati who arranges these classes.